My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
States move to restrict or protect abortion rights amid the prospect of a post-Roe v. Wade America. Plus, the EU proposes a Russian oil ban. And as Russia prepares new economic relief, can it address the country's needs?
Businesses want components in order to go and manufacture things like cars, but they can't do it because the supply has been choked off. So the traditional playbook for spending a lot of money to fuel demand doesn't quite work in this situation.
It's Wednesday, May 4th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. State political leaders across the U.S. have begun proposing new abortion laws following the leak of a draft opinion that indicated the Supreme Court could soon overturn Roe v. Wade, which would make the legality of abortions a state issue. In South Dakota, Republican Governor Kristi Noem said she would immediately call for a special legislative session if Roe is overturned in order to, quote, guarantee that every unborn child has a right to life in South Dakota. In Alabama, a legislative leader promised action to quickly end abortion in the state. Top Democratic lawmakers in New York and California, meanwhile, say they'll push to amend their state constitutions to cement existing laws protecting abortion rights. In Ohio, venture capitalist and author of the book Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance, has won the state's Republican primary for a U.S. Senate seat in a victory that demonstrated former President Donald Trump's influence over GOP voters. After describing himself in the past as a never-Trump guy, Vance was backed by Trump after reversing his views on the former president and aggressively seeking his endorsement. Speaking to supporters on Tuesday night, Vance accused the media of forecasting the end of Trump's sway over the Republican Party.
They wanted to write a story that this campaign would be the death of Donald Trump's America First agenda. Ladies and gentlemen, it ain't the death of the America First agenda.
Turning to world news, the European Union is proposing a ban on imports of Russian crude oil within 6 months and refined oil products by the end of the year. That's according to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen today. She added that the EU's executive body is proposing to take Russia's biggest bank, Sberbank, as well as two other Russian banks off the SWIFT financial messaging system, as well as to ban three major Russian state-owned broadcasters from the EU. EU member states are set to start discussing those measures today. We'll have more on how Russia is trying to contain the effect of Western sanctions on its economy later in the show. A number of major U.S. companies such as Apple, Honeywell International, and General Electric are now warning that COVID-19 lockdowns in Shanghai and elsewhere in China are putting added strain on supply chains that could be felt well into the summer. WSJ reporter Joe Wallace has more.
Apple said it would take a sales hit of as much as $8 billion this quarter, mainly because of the lockdown in Shanghai. Honeywell International said that the measures to reduce the spread of coronavirus in China had curbed production at half of its plants in the country.
Even if the lockdowns lift soon, the ripple effects may be felt for months, as many of the cargo ships currently waiting outside Shanghai make their way to the U.S. And we are exclusively reporting that Elon Musk, who has agreed to take Twitter private in a $44 billion deal, says he could return the social media company to public ownership in as little as 3 years after buying it, according to sources. The Tesla chief has been speaking to potential investors such as private equity firms, which could help lower the $21 billion he plans to kick in to help pay for the deal. Just a few months ago, sales of non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, were hitting all-time highs, according to the data website Non-Fungible. But since then, the market has flatlined, with NFT sales down 92% as of this week compared to last September, and leaving many owners with digital assets worth a lot less than what they paid for them. WSJ reporter Paul Vigna covers Bitcoin and cryptocurrency for us, and he's been looking into what is going on here. Hey, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. So what is going on here? What is causing NFTs to seemingly fall out of favor so quickly?
Part of what's happening is just what's going on in the markets in general. You have inflation concerns, you have central banks changing monetary policy, stocks are going down, bonds are going down, cryptocurrencies are going down, and speculative bets in general are having an even harder time, and NFTs are a speculative bet. So part of it is just the general market dynamic. But also what you have is specific to the NFT market. So NFTs are non-fungible tokens. Each one is supposed to be its own sort of unique digital asset, and it is supposed to be valuable because of that uniqueness. The problem is it got so popular so fast that supply has overwhelmed demand. We got some data that said there have been more than 9 million of these things created, and there have been less than 2 million buyers. So you have a lot of supposedly unique, special, distinctive digital assets for a small pool of buyers.
And yet, Paul, some backers of NFTs are still really enthusiastic about them. So could NFTs evolve?
I don't think NFTs are going to go away as a product, as an asset class. But I think what you're going to see is that in the future, you're not going to be able to just create a bunch of digital JPEGs and sell them and make a ton of money. You're going to have to offer the user something very tangible. And that's what's going to be interesting about these, is that they are going to become more utilitarian. And you're seeing that already. You're seeing bands create NFTs and sell them, and they're offering things like backstage passes or, you know, win a dinner with the band. And I think that's what you're going to see moving forward with the NFT market. It's going to be less about buy this thing that's going to go up in value. It's a real great speculative bet. And more about buy this thing that has some actual tangible real world interest to you. And it's a collectible and you get some goodies on the side.
That was WSJ reporter Paul Vigna. Paul, thank you for the update.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Moscow is preparing a new economic relief package to soften the blow of Western sanctions. But will it be enough? We've got that story after the break.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Russia is turning on the spending taps. President Putin is assembling a major new relief package to soften the blow of Western sanctions on Russia since the start of the war in Ukraine. And Journal reporter Alex Osipovich says the details of this package may shed light on the challenges facing Russia's economy, as well as the Kremlin's resiliency. And Alex joins us with a look now at those details. Hi, Alex. Welcome.
Hi, Luke. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. So break down, if you could, what is in this economic relief package that is being assembled now?
So there are a lot of moving pieces to this package, but I would say that it breaks down into two general areas. First of all is aid to businesses, and the second is aid to individuals. With the businesses, essentially, they're talking a lot about providing subsidized loans and essentially cheap financing to larger companies, ones that employ a lot of people, as well as smaller and medium-sized businesses, though the accent seems to be on the big businesses, the sort of anchors of the Russian economy that can employ tens of thousands of employees. At the same time, there's also been a lot of talk about raising pensions and aid payments to the needy, to state employees who are a huge chunk of the Russian population, to help them catch up with inflation.
And Alex, what does the potential level of spending on these new measures maybe reveal about the financial assets that Russia currently has access to?
Russian officials haven't put a total price tag on the package, but they have floated some preliminary numbers. The finance minister said last month that the initial measures that had been agreed so far would cost 2.5 trillion rubles, which works out to about $35 billion. And that's in spending. In addition to that, there's going to be a lot of loans. So not direct spending, but cheap financing extended to companies, which might need to be paid back eventually. And that could be substantially larger, in the ballpark of $100 billion. I think what this says is that Russia has deep pockets. There's a sense in the West that sanctions triumphed and really hammered Russia. And that's maybe half true. The other half of it is that Russia does have the ability to respond to these things and adapt. And one of its strengths is that it amassed a large amount of windfall revenue from its oil and gas exports over the years, and it is now going to spend down this rainy day fund. And that will allow Russia to spend a lot of money on shoring up its economy without having to go and print that money, which would run the risk of causing hyperinflation.
How well does this package of relief measures that Russia is considering actually address the challenges the country and its economy are facing?
That's a great question. There is a bit of a mismatch between what Russia can do in terms of fiscal spending and Russia's needs. Traditionally, in economic crisis, you have a problem with demand. People don't have enough money to buy stuff, and then businesses sort of wither away and lay people off as a result of that. So when COVID hit the United States, we spent trillions of dollars literally on stimulating demand. That's the classic playbook. What Russia is having right now is quite different. As a result of these sanctions, there is a supply crunch. A lot of imported goods, including components used for manufacturing, have been cut off by Western sanctions or by companies that just don't want to do business with Russia anymore. And so Russians have the money to spend. They want to go and buy those things. Businesses want those components in order to go and manufacture things like cars. But they can't do it because the supply has been choked off. So the traditional playbook for spending a lot of money to fuel demand doesn't quite work in this situation. You probably do want to spend some money and give people money so that they aren't falling into poverty, but you can't really stimulate growth with that. Probably the most that Russia can hope to do is loan money on favorable rates to its big businesses and allow them to rejigger their supply chains so that they don't need those imported components anymore.
So to what extent will this package actually benefit ordinary Russians and affect public sentiment as a result?
The short answer is that the measures that the government is taking are a band-aid. They will maybe stop some of the bleeding, but people are still facing very hard times, especially as the impact of the sanctions sort of sinks in over the coming months and companies have mass layoffs. I think the most that they will achieve is that there'll be this perception that, well, the government is doing something. People will see that their pension payments and their salaries are a bit higher. There'll be the sense that, well, at least the government is saying it's doing something. But I think that realistically, Russians face very hard times ahead, and these relief measures aren't going to do too much to solve that.
That was WSJ reporter Alex Osipovich. Alex, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, here's an alternative to those daily word puzzles on our phones. It's called Kryptos, and it's not an app, but a 12-foot-tall sculpture by artist Jim Sanborn that's located at CIA headquarters in Virginia and which contains a secret message filled with 1,800 random letters and 4 question marks. And that secret message has not been cracked for more than 30 years. Author A.J. Jacobs explains why Kryptos keeps drawing people in.
They have solved 3 of the 4 parts, but that 4th part remains unsolved, and it drives people crazy, which is what keeps people going. It's only 97 characters, but it's the most exasperating 97 letters on planet Earth. Not even the CIA has been able to solve this puzzle completely. So they are shocked that it is still going, and that thousands of people online are still obsessing over it.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.